You know, if more drug dealers thought about who would violently avenge the people they killed, maybe, just maybe, there would be less killing in the world. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insights into the creative process of storytelling. Folks, today was a fun episode, as I always enjoy the chance to interview an actor about their craft, and I was lucky to have Dar Salim chat about his dramatic action performance in Darkland. So Darkland is an edgy Danish crime thriller, and you could watch it on the newly launched streaming service Row8.com. Row 8 stands for the eighth row of a theater, where they like to say the best seats are, and the goal of the site is to bring you some of the best films from around the world. Row8.com recently launched with Darkland as one of their first films, and the good news for you is that if you'd like to watch Darkland either before listening to this Q&A or after it, you could use coupon code $5OFFMOVIE. That's all one word, so $5. Then the word off movie, all crammed together as one word, and you can enter that code during checkout to save $5 off Darkland or any movie at row8.com while the deal is active. So I hope you go check out Darkland at row8.com. As for our guest, Dar Salim, he had a lot of great things to say about his craft and what it's like for him as a performer in both his dramatic scenes and his action scenes, so I know you'll dig this episode. And speaking of things to dig, we recently published issue 33 of Backstory Magazine over at backstory.net. It's our Mission Impossible Fallout issue and features interviews with editor Eddie Hamilton and stars Rebecca Ferguson and Henry Cavill, plus writer-director Christopher McQuarrie. And believe it or not, there will be a Tom Cruise interview that's going to be added to the issue as well, because I just did that interview yesterday and now I'm going to write it up and add it to the issue. That's the fun of digital publishing. You could always add things to an issue, even once it's out there. Plus, there's plenty of other great film and TV content to read in issue 33, along with a full-length screenplay. In fact, you could see our entire table of contents right now at backstory.net. So I hope you'll show your support by buying a single issue or consider subscribing and check us out. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right onto the stage at the Harmony Gold Theater in Hollywood, right as I introduce the star of the crime drama Darkland, Dar Salim.
Thanks for coming down.
Okay. We're going to start moderating. We'll take a question or two from you guys at the end, and then, of course, raffle off a couch, as they do in Denmark, right? It's a big Denmark thing, raffle off a couch. You know, speaking of Denmark, Dar, to my knowledge, you were a royal guard in the Danish army and served at the royal palace as well as with the 1st Battalion. When did you decide to get away from that and go into the arts?
Well, as soon as they let me go after 1 year, that's then. Do you guys understand what I'm saying, or do you need subtitles?
Well, so did you always want to act?
I never wanted to act. I never wanted to be an actor, or I didn't grow up in a place where people became actors or directors. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a theater school. So that's something that came very late in life.
Well, you trained at the William Esper Studio in New York, to my knowledge. Is that correct?
I attended. I was enrolled.
You were enrolled, all right.
I was there for a few weeks, and then I got work, and then I had to fly out.
Well, so would you say that you had formal training, or was it more learning on the job?
My training, I'd say it was. You know, becoming an actor is just, there's no one way of doing it. You can take all the courses in the world, but unless you know how to pick what works for you and you can use your own story and imagination, then it's not going to work. And for me, the best lessons came through an actress called Sara Bobea, which is one of our finest in Copenhagen. She took me in for 2 years and we did, 14-minute Shakespeare monologues in my living room. She was my audience, so that was a big thing. And second part of my training was on the job. So many of the mistakes that my colleagues make in a protected environment, I did on prime time in Danish TV.
Well, it seems like your first break was in 2003 with the show Forsar, if I'm pronouncing it correct.
Yeah, that's true. That was my first job ever, actually. That was
right.
It was a big show back home, and that's how it started. A friend of mine for some reason went to an audition. It was just a typecasting. They needed guys in the mid-20s who looked like they could box or fight or whatever. And he convinced me to come along. I think he said he'd buy me lunch or something. So I went along, and they said that I should do it as well. And it was just for a small part. But then she said, well, you go home and read this instead. And then I came back and I got the guest lead in one of the episodes.
What was your biggest lesson on your first gig, kind of the trial by fire?
It was that it came naturally to me to be like present, and you know, when the magic happens, it was just pure instinct. I had no technique or any previous experience, but it just worked. And then you know, the bug was planted and I couldn't focus on anything else. I continued my life, but I was just, somehow I knew that I've never had this feeling before. So actually I went to a library and said, because I didn't know any actors, so I said, do you have any books on acting? And she pointed me towards a Stanislavski book, and I took that.
Of course. Was it helpful? Did you like the Stanislavski book that you read?
Absolutely. I could recognize every page.
Awesome. Modern audiences, contemporary audiences over here in the United States, really, you appeared on our radar with 2011's Devil's Double, a feature film that you were in. What was your biggest lesson from that?
That most of the time you get edited out of these films.
Yeah? So your role
so
was...
just don't do it.
Your role was bigger?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was huge on paper, but it was a good experience to be on like an international set and work with Lee Tamahori, who did, Once Were Warriors, one of my favorites, and Dominic Cooper. And it was just good to see that once the hype was gone, it was just the same job. It was just actors and a director on coke saying action.
What was your worst audition? What was the audition that still to this day haunts you when you think back on it? Because I know actors have to sometimes go through some crazy hoops.
Honestly, I don't have a horrible audition. I think the only reason I'm still here is, you know, when I came into the industry in Denmark, it's a very small, closed industry. Most of them come from the same way and have backgrounds which are in the arts. But the only reason I'm here is because I think my first 9 or 10 auditions, I got the part.
That's awesome. I mean, obviously American audiences and worldwide audiences, you came onto everybody's radar with Game of Thrones. You were in season one as Quathwo. Tell us what it was like landing that gig and being on season one of this show that was, I'm sure, a bit humbler in its beginnings as it grew into a truly cultural phenomenon.
I was doing Borgen in Denmark when I got called in for an audition in London, and I was literally, they didn't know who I was, or I was just sitting in line with 20 other guys. And, you know, nobody knew what it was. It was just this fantasy thing that HBO was doing. So it was a good experience to do it, but we didn't even have HBO in Denmark at the time. So I did it. It was aired. Nobody noticed. And, you know, 3 or 4 seasons later, everybody knew what Game of Thrones was. There were posters everywhere in Copenhagen. And then some of my friends started working on it, and they got all the success and the attention. But then actually people, you know, found out. And then you have to talk about it 5 and 6 years later that you were in Game of Thrones. Yes, 8 years ago.
What do you remember? What was one of your favorite days on set?
It was actually, it was just a fun production because Jason Momoa, who, you know, became a friend later, he's just a guy's guy. And Emilia, it was just a very nice atmosphere, very relaxed, and we had a lot of fun every day.
As far as fights go, and there's a lot of fights in this movie, and I swear we're going to get to this movie in a minute or so, what was your final death scene like with Jorah?
Unfair, I feel.
Cheated,
and so unrealistic. I mean, how many here believes that Jorah could kill Kotho? I feel that was like the weak point of season one.
I want to talk about your habit for a second. When you break down a character, How much of a backstory do you get into your character, or is that something that you like to do?
I go from the script. Sometimes if the script just feels natural and talks to you, whatever works, you don't have to explain it. You just say it's talent and it just go with it. But when it's badly written, like some TV shows I've done in Denmark, which are very successful, but in 45 minutes, they want to tell six different stories, which means that every story gets one scene, which means that you have to say how you feel and not show it. That's where you learn your craft. That's where you learn that to be able to say anything and make it believable. So you do whatever it takes.
How important is rehearsal to your process, and how often do you get it?
Very much. I'm a nerd. I love the rehearsal, and I love to be prepared. And I think 99% of the preparation is just you don't show it. But once it's done, I think you don't have to do that much once they say action, because then it's all there.
Did you have rehearsal for Darkland?
Oh yes, yeah. That was. A long process because...
Get into that. Tell us how Darkland came onto your radar.
The director, Finar, who unfortunately couldn't be here, he would love to be here. He talked to me a couple of years before the film and said he has this idea, and I said, yes, let's do it. And they started writing the script, and we kept in touch. And I think for me that you have to understand that Danish cinema is, as you saw, it's a different pace, and it's, you can't just save the world, do a one-liner and a joke and get away with it. It's somehow has to be realistic, if that makes sense. So with that guy, I think for me it made sense when I realized that that the price he had to pay to reach his goal, the environment he grew up in, that price was just too high, that he had to like surgically erase his whole family and background and leave them behind to make it to where he is. And 20 years of that builds up an anger and a shame. And I thought, you have to show that in the film, but you only had the first few scenes. So you had to show that this guy was extreme. So if he was born into a Formula One family or a football family, he would have made it to the top of that. They made him a surgeon, a heart surgeon, which is clever because it has, you have life and death in your hands. So that was what broke the character down for me. And then you had to do the preparation, the physical, the training, the learning to ride a bike and all that.
Well, right. And when it comes to the exposition about his past, about Zaid's past, you see that it seemed like he was in a dojo training for martial arts, and he clearly knows how to fight. He's not just a doctor. Was there ever any more about his past and his ability to be kind of a man of action?
Absolutely. I mean, if he did not follow that path, if he had stayed, he would probably have been the other guy, Simeon. He was going to be the leader of wherever direction he chose. So yeah, he had a violent background. He used to train, but he used it in a positive way to get out of his environment.
I'm curious if Finar or his co-writer Adam August ever talked to you about the movie Get Carter, the classic Michael Caine movie that's about the avenging a brother's death. Was that something that was kind of resonating here for Darkland?
It's going to be a boring answer, but no, we never spoke
of
that.
Okay, good. No, it's fine. I had to ask. I mean, I know that to my knowledge, you left Iraq in 1977 and moved to Denmark. And this movie definitely has commentary about the Iraqi community in Denmark. Talk about kind of some of the discussions you guys were having about how to portray both sides of it. Because you have the heart surgeon, and then you have the kids that are a little lost on the street.
Yeah, I was born in 77. I'm not that old, dude. So we didn't leave Iraq in 77.
Got it.
A few years later, we left. And but you make a very good point. I think that's a thing we have in Europe, France, Germany, Denmark, wherever you go, Holland, you have these communities of young people with different ethnical backgrounds who do not feel as part of society. And they create their own rules and they basically live in a jungle outside society. Which can be very difficult to understand for people who live within the society, because you have healthcare and you have all the education you want. And but you know, as human beings, we tend to only see what's just in front of us. So even though it's across the street, it's a different planet for these kids. And unless somebody shows them how to walk across the street and become part of society, they'll just stay and follow their own rules. So it was important for us to show that. It doesn't have to be Iraqi, it could be anything, just a different ethnical background than white Danish. But we didn't want to make a movie about like a typical story of a guy that he gets helped and then he makes it. It had to be within a story that we thought was a good action film. First and foremost, if that works, then we can talk about these things after. So I think that's an important part of the film, to show the division in the society and how it's important to try to bring these two together.
I mean, it's interesting because a few times the little mobster teens, you know, and whatnot, they refer to Zaid as white man, you know, when they bump into him on the street. And it shows this division even within the community, that from their perspective of being like on the streets, that anybody that goes outside of the community to be in more of the secular Danish community is somehow ostracized or looked down upon in their eyes. I thought that was kind of interesting. Is that something that you've seen? Is that a thing that exists?
I think it does. I'm sure it exists here as well. I mean, if someone makes it in the establishment, you will be frowned upon. But at the same time, my personal experience, my story, I'm the first. Denmark is a very small country, and it's many thousand years old, and they all look the same. And the industry is even smaller. So I'm truly the first actor in Denmark who is not a blonde Dane, who has made it to be a leading man on TV and film and sell tickets, and kind of broken a glass ceiling. And I have never felt anything but love from my old community and young kids with different, you know, ethnical backgrounds. I think, on the contrary, they see that if he can do it, then I can do what I want.
It's interesting because in the movie, and we're gonna get into spoilers now. So for our podcast listeners who have not seen the movie, press pause, go see it, and come back and listen to the rest of this. It's interesting because the whole movie, Zaid is haunted by the idea that he wasn't able to give his brother 100,000 when his brother needed it, but I think what's interesting is, would that really have saved his brother? Because it would seem that his downward trajectory into a life of crime would have continued, and if it wasn't this 100,000, it would have been something else. And I'm just kind of curious to hear from you on that perspective, because the whole movie is predicated on this haunting Zaid.
I don't think 100,000 would have made a difference. I think what Zaid, the brother needed was Zaid's time and attention and love and care and guidance. And was what he didn't give him. That's what I started by saying, that the price he paid to achieve his goals are unreasonable. It's too big of an ask. You know, if he was born in a white middle class, to become a surgeon would be this far of a journey. But to be born in minus 1,000 and then to become a heart surgeon in the number one hospital in Denmark, it was too big of an ask. But he had the ambition to do it. The price was to cut off his family, to cut off his background. It might have started with not coming home for Sunday dinner and not coming home for birthdays.
Right, he let work kind of dictate.
He let work and his own ambitions, new friends, just let everything go. So what the brother needed was not the 100,000, he needed Zaid in his life to take care of him and to take care of his family and to stand by the fact where he comes from and not to be ashamed of his roots. and only to sit with the privileged white cultural intellectual people and drinking red wine. That was the problem, not the 100,000.
That also gets into his wife, who's an outsider from the community, just like he is, because she's not from the community. And she kind of seems to be the moral grounding for Zaid that he keeps coming back to as he's starting to kind of spin out of control with his own obsession. Tell me about how that kind of affected your performance as those scenes, you know, slow things down a little and give you kind of a mirror to reflect in.
I think, you know, first of all, Stine Fisher is a fantastic actress, and she did a really good job with the very limited amount of scenes that she had, because she truly comes across, as you say, as the moral compass. I think in all our lives, what matters is family. You know, that's what truly makes us happy or sad. And that goes for Zaid as well. That's instinctive, that goes across cultures and journeys and whatever he's been through. So, of course, he feels that this is where he's supposed to be, this is what he's supposed to do, but the circumstances are just bigger than him.
What was the budget and schedule for Darkland?
The biggest Danish film would be considered a low-budget U.S. film. This was a low-budget Danish film. So I think we did this for maybe $2 million, maybe less.
Dollars or euros?
Dollars.
Okay, wow.
Maybe less.
It's great. All went up on the screen. It looks awesome. And what was the schedule? How long did that buy you to shoot?
We shot for 6 weeks.
Okay. When you do your fighting, do you do your own stunts, or do you mix and match as to which stunts you'll do?
I mix and match. We did our own fights, and we did it was important to me that everything that Zaid did was in line with his character. Otherwise, you'd lose him. And so it was important for me that he didn't show any emotion unless he was alone. So he didn't show anything before the wife fell asleep, or he sent her in, or even when the nurse comes in. He doesn't want to show emotion. And at the same time, when he fights, he doesn't, like the stuntman would suggest, jump on the wall and then kick him. And I'm like, why would he?
He's right. You know, it's too flashy.
It's too flashy. So what Zaid's superpower was that he just didn't give up. He would always get back up. So these are the things that I influenced the fighting with and made those kind of decisions. When somebody had to get thrown through the things that, you know, break, we called in the stuntman.
What was your most difficult stunt? What was the one that was the toughest for you to pull off? That
it was the final fight with Ali, because Ali is, you know, he's a great guy, but he just, you know, he wings it. And anybody who's been on a film set knows that's just not the way to do it. So
you're talking about the fight with Simeon.
Yeah, with Simeon. Yeah. So that was a tough fight. I hit, you know, the uppercut when I hit his nose. I actually do hit his nose.
Oh no!
And he pushed one of my ribs and stuff. So that was a tough. That was a tough thing.
That the shot where you kick him through the window to
his death is.
Too bad. R.I.P. That was an incredible shot. I mean, that was because the camera tracks through the window with him, and you see him fall straight down onto the pavement. Tell us about the setup for that shot and how they did it, I would guess, in stages.
I cannot give you the specifics other than to say that Kasper Tuxen, who shot the film, is one of the world's greatest DOPs, and he works here as well, and he's a ninja. He is a ninja, and he can make anything look amazing. And he uses the newest technology, and at the same time he would use a hanger for clothes, and he just builds something with a mirror and he puts it together. And then
was it green screened, kicking him out of the window and having him fall?
No, it was somebody.
Oh, it was wires.
Wired, yeah.
Wow.
The stuntman was wired.
So it was probably done at a different frame rate, so it seemed like he was falling fast, but it was slow-mo, I would guess.
I cannot answer that.
I mean, it was beautiful.
We called Tuxen afterwards and asked him.
It was beautiful. The other really kind of strange but awkward fight that you had was with Bronco in the front seat of the car, where you're laying down and having your eye pushed in. What were the logistical challenges of that?
Well, the logistical challenges was the guy was actually punching me in the face because he's never done a movie before.
That's bad.
This Branko is actually a very big rap star in Denmark, and he's a very good rapper. But he's a true rapper, so he doesn't, you know, he needs maybe a drink before this we start shooting or because of his nerves. And so it was very interesting to be cramped in a car like that. But we wanted it to be like that. We wanted it to be dirty, like all the fights. We didn't want, because we knew all the kids were going to watch this film, we didn't want to glorify the violence. Right. We wanted it to be disgusting. And I think we succeeded in that.
You definitely succeeded. So was wearing that bloody contact annoying then for the rest of the movie?
Yes.
I would think that's not so good.
It's always too big, and it's always, yeah.
I couldn't imagine that. Zaid goes to the hospital a couple times, and he's taking shots. I'm guessing, what is it, actually? I'm not going to even guess. What is he taking?
Yeah, a lot of people ask that. I think it's a type of, a combination of painkillers and adrenaline and stuff to keep him going. It's not like steroids, or that doesn't make sense. It's more like stuff to keep you going.
It would seem that this is a movie that I could imagine there being some cut scenes. Were there any? Like, were there scenes that now that you watch it, you kind of still miss? Going back to what you said about Devil's Double, in which there's good stuff left on the cutting room floor?
There are definitely some good scenes cut out, but I do not miss them.
Tell us what some of them were.
You know, there's always like over-explanatory scenes, like when I go back after the guy is burned and I talk to Dulfi again, the new little brother. There are some more scenes with Stine, which, you know, that would have been good. But I think they chose, the editor did a great job, and they chose really the scenes that tell the story.
What was a personal moment for you? What was a moment in the movie that you had just kind of a personal agenda that you wanted to put a part of you into a scene?
I'd say that had to be, and it's probably my favorite scene of the film, is with the father and the couch. Because I think I've had a lot of response on that scene as well from kids saying, you know, that's the thing that they wanted to say to their dad that they never could. Most of these things that go wrong is because a generation come, and I'm not blaming anyone, it's just a fact. When you come into a new country and you don't know the language and you've been through wars and terrors, you deal with your own stuff. And so the kids are left alone to figure out their own moral compass and their own social rules, and that's what creates these parallel societies. And so I enjoyed that scene. It wasn't totally scripted like that. I had an idea, so just roll it. And I said, is that Iraq? You know, because he's sitting in the same place in Denmark. He's sat there for 30 years like so many others, and they still have a lot of pride and a lot of, you know, it's just warm air. It's nothing.
It's such a short scene too, but it had the power because he's reminding his father that we do not live in Iraq anymore.
I live in Iraq, and you have a responsibility to get your ass off the couch and educate your son.
It was a great scene. Folks, we recently released issue 33 at Backstory.net, and you could read Backstory Magazine on a desktop, laptop, iPad, or via Google Play on an Android tablet. Issue 33 is our Mission Impossible Fallout issue, and we've got 5 great articles from the film that include stars Henry Cavill and Rebecca Ferguson, and editor Eddie Hamilton, plus a big article with writer Christopher McQuarrie, and then another big article with director Christopher McQuarrie. And yeah, sure, our McQuarrie articles have some overlap with the podcast Q&A, but the articles most importantly have new content that is not found in the podcast that gets into the nitty-gritty details about Chris's process. So I didn't even bother to re-ask him some of those questions for the podcast because I knew we already had it covered so well in the magazine. What's really cool is that even though we've already published, we are updating the magazine with new articles. I like to call it post-publishing, as Chris is going to give us insight into the pre-production process, likely via some script pages, characters, but also storyboards like he did for Rogue Nation and Backstory. And we're even talking about some pre-viz videos and maybe some iPhone videos, so check back to see what we wind up adding to the magazine sometime soon. As for the rest of issue 33, we went to the Writers Guild Foundation Library for a research piece on the original Mission Impossible TV show and found an amazing style guide that creator Bruce Geller wrote for his writer's room that truly outlines what he wanted the template of the show to be. So you could view that in an article as well. Backstory issue 33 is full of plenty of other cool film and TV pieces featuring the showrunners of the Karate Kid sequel, TV's Cobra Kai, along with the showrunners of the new Stephen King show, Castle Rock, plus the showrunner behind Marvel's Luke Cage season 2. You can even read a full-length Blacklist screenplay entitled George by Jeremy Michael Cohn, plus an interview with Jeremy as well. We interviewed debut writer-director Boots Riley about his Sundance breakout, Sorry to Bother You, Ant-Man and the Wasp director Peyton Reed, and the issue has plenty of other great content as well, so I hope you take a look over at our table of contents at backstory.net and consider subscribing. You know, as a subscriber, you'll have access to every issue we've ever published, and if you're in the mood to subscribe, please do so at backstory.net because then more of your subscription dollars will actually stay with the magazine. And the good news is, you'll still be able to use your login credentials to sign in and read us on the iPad if you have one. So it's a steal of a deal no matter how you look at it. And if you don't want to subscribe, you could buy a single issue of issue 33 right there too. So remember, you could read us on desktops, laptops, iPads, and via the Google Play app on Android tablets. So we've done our best to make it kind of easy for you to find us. And look, it really means a lot to me to have my podcast listeners check out backstory.net. So thanks for stopping by and consider reading issue 33. And don't forget, if you want to watch Darkland and save $5 at checkout, simply use coupon code $5OffMovie. That's the dollar sign, the number 5, and the word off movie, all crammed together as a discount coupon code that you could use during checkout at row8.com while the deal is active, so I hope you go for it. But now let's jump right back into my conversation with actor Dar Salim about his performance in Darkland.
Tell me about the redemption of Zaid in the end, because, you know, he's already fixed one of his victims in the hospital. And now you have this kid that he decides to drive to the hospital, yeah. But he probably knows that things are not going to keep going his way for too much longer. But it's almost like the doctor's side of Zaid kind of kicks back in, in which he's not going to leave this kid to bleed out either.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. That's the schizophrenic side of Zaid, because he's been drawn into this dark land side of himself for so long at that point, you know, that he's lost, basically, you've lost for the last 10 minutes of the film, you've lost Zaid as we know him in the beginning. But, you know, it's instinct. He's a doctor, you know. He sees this kid, he's bleeding, and he wakes up from the blood rush.
What do you think happens to Zaid afterwards, after he's taken away?
You'll have to watch Darkland 2 to find out.
I would, by the way. I would definitely watch that. Tell us, what was your toughest scene? What was the scene as an actor that actually, and your toughest action scene too, but as an actor, what was your toughest scene, the one that you kept getting the sweats over before you did it over and over again, the one that you kept feeling that you needed to prepare for more than you really did? What was the scene that kind of you were nervous going into?
You know, I have a ton of those scenes when we did Borgen or Dicte or stuff sure. like that. But honestly, I didn't have that feeling with... It felt magical from day one because the whole production was done in a way that should have been impossible. Like, but it just didn't feel like a problem because...
Well, what should have been impossible?
Well, I just told you about the budget, for instance.
Right.
And so the time kept running out. And like, I'll give you an example. The scene where Dulfi, the new kid, he's been beaten, and I come up. I think we had maybe one, two takes to do it
for Alex when you're putting
for
the pillows
Alex, exactly.
by his head and everything. Yeah.
So there was no dialogue in that scene. So I called a doctor friend of mine, and I said to him, "Listen, I'm a doctor. So when I come to this in this situation, I can't just say anything like anybody. I have to be professional." So he said what I had to say, and I couldn't remember it right then and there, so I wrote it down on the pizza box in front of me, and I told Tuxton to shoot from the other side so I could look at the pizza box, pretending to look at Alex and reading my lines as I speak on the phone, finishing the phone call, and then we can play the scene. So it was stuff like that all the time to make it work. Like the scene, I don't know if we should say this, when, you know, when I drive the kid to the hospital and run the red lights. I was running the red lights.
What time was it?
That was in the middle of the night, and okay. The shoot was over. And so just me and the director and the DOP, who said, we're going to drive the car back to base. And we, so this film, you cannot do it again the way we did it. So it never felt, I was never nervous, or I was so well prepared for that film, and I was so looking forward to doing it, that it just, it was a good thing.
You gave a fantastic performance. Your acting chops are, of course, up to par. I'm curious, have you ever felt the need or the want to write or direct?
No, I don't want to be a director. You know, he comes first and he leaves last, and he gets paid less than me. So why would I do that? But
smart man.
Having said that, I think that when you tell stories, it has to come from a place. And I do have a story that I worked on back home, which is like a modern form of Kramer versus Kramer, which is a personal thing for me. I think in our society in Denmark, we have 60% people divorced, including myself, and sharing kids, and we don't really deal with it. It's just become a norm. So that script is written, and it's being rewritten now, and we'll see what happens with that.
Does it have a title?
It has a Danish title. I don't even know how to translate it. An easy translation would be "The One Who Lives in My Heart."
What is it in Danish?
Iten mit hjerte bor.
All right, because I'm going to try and use Google Translate on it, damn it, and I'll see what Google Translate right. says. We have time to take a few quick questions from the crowd. It's right there, you, sir, in the red shirt. Interesting question. Do you feel that your actual life sometimes feeds into your character, or that your character, as you're doing preparation, feeds into your actual life?
That is a good question. I think that the more experience you get, the easier it becomes to take off your working clothes and go home. My first feature film was a mess. Like, it was a very dark film, and I was in it for 2 months. Today you can do like the most dramatic scene, and then they say cut, and you joke with your colleagues, and then you go back into it. But there's no formula to it. For me, I do what it takes, and I do what it takes on the day for it to work. So if I need to joke around and be an idiot, then I'll on set, not to others, but you know what I mean, just joke around, and I'll do that. And if I need to be quiet and have my privacy, then that's what you have to do.
Right there. At what point were you finally comfortable enough to call yourself an actor? Great question.
That's a very good question. Not even after I did my first feature. You know, I did my first feature, and it was in theaters, and we won Rotterdam Film Festival, and I was nominated for all kinds of stuff, but it just felt like not yet. But then I got a lead on the Danish national scene, and after I did that, I was like, okay.
Right there in the front row. Two questions. What movies as a kid touched you or influenced you as an actor? And also on Darkland, how did you work with your director, and how do you prefer to work with a director?
Well, I work with the director the way that can help the director tell his story. I think that's our job. You give them all you have, but at the end of the day, it's their film. And if you have a really, really good idea, you have to convince them it's their idea.
And then the old manipulation.
Yes. So, but I had a good relationship with Finar. He, you know, we trusted each other. I have a lot of respect for him for putting this team together and making this happen and having this vision and the balls to do a genre film for less than $2 million. And he gave me the freedom to work on the character and the trust to do that.
Sometimes when an actor and a director collaborate that closely, there's a rewrite. So were there any rewrites that were kind of ideas that you wanted him and Adam to kind of change in the script for you?
Again, in my preparation, I was very meticulous. So I did ask for a meeting before we even started shooting, where we went through the script line by line and changed a lot of stuff. And on the day, we had to adjust. And also because we work with a lot of amateurs that don't do film. So you have to, as a lead, normally you can lean back and let everyone else do the work and you just react to it. But in this film, you had to do whatever it takes to make them shine for the film to shine.
What were some of the changes that you wanted before you started shooting?
Man, I think stuff like in the beginning of the film, I wanted to make him as quiet as possible and not engage in discussions with Simeon or his wife or show too much. I wanted him to be quiet, angry. I wanted him to be like a bomb.
Yeah, the scene with Simeon at the restaurant where Simeon's just verbally attacking him, yeah. He doesn't get so much as a response.
No, and the, you know, original script, I had at least as many lines as he did.
Oh, really? Interesting. And then the second part of the question was your influences as a kid, as an actor.
Well, I had no idea that I was going to be an actor. The films I loved were, I was very touched by Kramer versus Kramer, which is still one of my favorite films. And another film that influenced me a lot was Karate Kid.
Great,
you know,
film.
Wax on, wax off. It's a classic, you know? I don't even know if it's a good film today if I watch
it. It's a great film. Wait, have you been watching Cobra Kai?
No, I haven't watched Cobra
Kai. Do you know about it?
No. Oh, sorry, what is that?
No, you're going to love it. You're going to love it.
So the audience is disappointed now.
No. It's just a thing that's really big in America right now, in which they got the actors of Karate Kid as adults.
To do what?
To be in a new movie in that universe as kind of enemies, but now they're raising their own kids.
Is that on Row 8? Can we get it on Row 8, the film?
It's YouTube.
YouTube. All right.
And how many episodes would you guys say there are? Is it 6 or is it 8? It's somewhere in between. You'll love it.
I'll have to watch it. No, but Karate Kid for me was, I was like a skinny little kid, and so I totally identified with him, and I found a karate club, and I joined, and I did it for 4 or 5 years, and it started me off to become. It was my first success was to do karate, so Karate Kid was, and then I watched Van Damme and all the blood sports, right, and the kickboxer, and then obviously then you started watching real films like. The Godfathers and Deer Hunter and all these films.
But it starts with wax on, wax off.
Starts with wax on, wax off, always.
Always. So what's next? What's something next that we're going to see you on? What have you been working on that we should keep an eye out for?
Star Wars. I'm the hero of the new Star Wars film. No.
Fantastic.
I don't know. We'll see. I've taken some time off this year for the first time ever, and because there's a I've worked so much last year also after the, what's called After Dark Line, we did a new TV series called Warrior, which is gonna, I think, have a Netflix worldwide, and another Danish film that comes out. So now I've taken the rest of this year basically off from Danish productions, and who knows, maybe I'll end up in a US film sometime.
Good.
I just want to thank, you know, people for coming out and watching this film with subtitles LA for the first time. I'm really proud of it, and I'm thankful that you did it. And also, thank you very much to Row 8. So I'm proud of that. Darkland was the first film that they had. So thank you for that, Row 8.
Give it up again for Dar Salim.
Thank you so much.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to actor Dar Salim for coming down and being so generous with his time when discussing his latest film, Darkland. And don't forget, if you want to watch Darkland and save $5 at checkout, simply use coupon code $5OffMovie. That's the dollar sign, the number 5, and the word off movie all crammed together, and you could use it at checkout at row8.com while the deal is active, so I hope you go for it. And while you're surfing around online, I also hope you'll check out issue 33 of Backstory Magazine at backstory.net. It's our Mission Impossible Fallout issue where you could read interviews with stars Henry Cavill and Rebecca Ferguson, and of course writer-director Chris McCrory, and we are still adding to that issue as we're going to go live with a great Tom Cruise interview that we recently completed, so that will be added to the issue soon as well. There's also plenty of other TV and film articles and an entire screenplay for you to read, and you could check out our entire table of contents at backstory.net. And while you're there, you could decide if you'd like to buy a single issue or subscribe, so thanks in advance for stopping on by. The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2018. All rights reserved. And hey, if you'd like to show your support and donate to this free podcast so I can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds to pay for my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.